Well, good morning and welcome. You are listening to another edition of The Plotting Shed. This is Rachel McCartane. I hope you are all having a very lovely morning, or depending on where you're listening to me in the world, whether it is a lovely evening or a lovely afternoon. It's raining again here, once again. We have another dollop load coming through, so I'm sitting here, the sky is grey, and it is persisting down outside, and we've got it for the whole day. I am so looking forward to spring happening. I haven't even been able to walk on my grass since December. It's like the water table is now literally at ground level. So if you step on the grass and your foot sinks down into the soft grass, it quickly puddles up. I will be delighted to be able to walk around parts of my garden because I'm just keeping off the grass at the moment. It's too wet. And we live in one of the driest parts of the country. I mean, we're right down here on the south coast, very close to a place called Bognor Regis, which is officially, although there is some dispute from other seaside resorts, but officially we are the sunniest part of the UK. We have a little microclimate because there is the Isle of Wight, which is just to the west of us, about 30 miles away, kind of deflects a lot of the weather just that little bit north. So very often the rain and various bits of bad weather are just deflected away from us, which is why we're sort of in this nice little enclave. But right now, it's not a nice enclave. It's absolutely chucking down and I'm bored with rain now. I'm bored with the wind. I'm bored with the grey. I'm bored with the wet. I mean, the daffodils are out, the crocuses are out, lots of plants are beginning to start to show their heads, and my garden is full of chickweed seeds that are coming through. And because it's so wet, I can't get into the garden to even weed them at the moment. It's a mud bath. So they're all going to flower and set seed before I even have a chance to get in. But having said that, spring will turn up. The sun is starting to get a little bit warmer in the sky and we will be able to go out and sit in the garden and have a cup of tea, and I can't wait. I thought what we'd talk about is knowing that we're going to get in the garden eventually, knowing that we all want to be able to sit outside, what would be really nice garden plants to have? Now, last week, my little podcast was about plants to avoid if you don't like gardening. So conversely, what we really need to do this week is to talk about the world's best plants, or my non-gardener's guide to the world's best plants. And for those of you who might not have heard it, it's on Apple Tunes, and it's on Spotify, and it's on Stitcher and various other podcast providers, but you will find it. It's entitled Plants to Avoid If You Don't Like Gardening. And we talked about speed spreaders, and we talked about triffids and high maintenance plant divas and bog offs, the plants where you buy one, instead of buy one, get one free, it's buy one, get 1,000 free. So this week, this is the flip side, that what constitutes the world's best plants. Now, before I start talking about anything, remember, I am talking about plants from the standpoint of the average gardener who has an ordinary sized garden, who, like me, has a busy life. They're juggling work, kids, domestic duties, having your own life, looking after the garden and everything else. Although I do like plants, obviously, I'm a garden designer, although I love being in my garden, it's not my primary focus. I have too many other things to do as well. From that perspective, this is all for people who love gardens, but haven't got time and just can't be uber dedicated gardeners. So the plants that I might choose for the garden are not necessarily ones that horticultural experts will choose, because those require too much time and effort and looking after. So how do we decide what will be a really good plant for the garden? Now, it goes without saying that if you want any plant to be good in the garden, you've got to put the right plant in the right place. So as soon as you start shoehorning plants that are unsuitable for the growing conditions, you're going to be planting a problem. And it's not the plant's fault that it's misbehaving. It's just that you've put it somewhere where it can't possibly do its own thing. If you're looking at creating a garden and getting really good plants for the garden, then right plant, right place is absolutely key, because then the plant will behave as it wants to. It will do its own thing at its own speed in its own way. And because it's looking after itself and is doing it quite happily, you don't have to look after it. And that, for me, ticks the first box of my category of what constitutes the world's best plant. And that is that it's well behaved. And on top of that, then obviously the plant is being self-sufficient. It looks after itself. If it does its own thing and it can do it quite happily without my intervention, then that's great. The plant is good in my garden. But for example, if you want to put a plant in that loves and thrives on damp, moist soil and plenty of sunshine and plenty of rainfall, and you live in a drier part of the world, it's not going to be very self-sufficient. It's not going to adapt to your climate very well. You are going to constantly have to look after it. It can't be the best plant for your garden. You know, you're looking for the Goldilocks plant. It's not too big, it's not too small, it doesn't grow too fast, it doesn't grow too slowly. It's just about right. It's that bit in the middle. Now, that doesn't mean you have to then fill your garden with very boring shrubs and plants that don't do anything, because there are plenty that do. And I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. As well as being well-behaved, self-sufficient and adaptable, there is one other criteria that fulfills the world's best plants category for me, and that is that it can't just be a pretty face. And what I mean by that is that I have no intention of buying plants that only have a gorgeous looking flower. But that gorgeous looking flower doesn't really do anything else. On two counts. The first is that the plant is only in flower for a few weeks of the year. So if all that it offers me is a pretty flower for 3 or 4 weeks out of 52, and the rest of the time it's a really dull, boring looking shrub or plant, then for the vast majority of the year, it's not good enough. I need that plant to work harder. So I need that plant to be scented, for example. I need that plant to maybe have different coloured foliage or different shaped foliage leaves. Maybe it's got to be nice to touch. Maybe the plant makes a nice noise as the wind blows through it. Maybe I can taste it. I can rub the leaves and I can smell the scent. I can grasp the scent of the plant. So in a small garden, a plant has to work really hard. So just sticking something that is pretty for a few weeks in the corner doesn't cut the mustard as far as I'm concerned. But there's a second aspect to not just being a pretty face, is that the plant in my garden, if it's going to earn its place, it also has to do good. And I need and I want my garden to be able to give back to the wildlife around it. It must provide food, because then my garden becomes more interesting, because I attract in moths, I attract in butterflies, I attract in bees, I attract in hoverflies and ladybirds, or ladybugs if you're in America, and I attract a whole ecosystem in because I have plants that animals and insects can feed from. So what would be the best plants to have? Well, I would be going for shrubs that would be slower growing. So they might get to about 6 foot in 8 to 10 years time, because then when I've put them in the garden, they're not going to take over too quickly. I also would look for what I would class as more originals. For a long time, we have been adapting and modifying plants. It's how we got wheat and barley, for example. They were originally wild grasses, and Stone Age settlers began to grow these, and they began to use those grasses and things that had bigger seed heads to grind the flour. And so we developed crops, you know, the wheats and the barleys and the corn. It's all been by selective breeding. And plant growers have done that for many, many, many years as well, that they cross-fertilise pollen from one flower to another to create a different flower. And that's all fine, because we're doing nothing more than what a bee would do by going from one flower to another. But horticulture moved on, and now we can do that a lot more scientifically. So now the plants are being tapped into at a cellular level, and they're creating more hybridized plants with better disease resistance and different petal structures and different colors, and they're creating a much more unnatural looking color combinations to sell to the general public. But the problem with a lot of this is because they're selling the plants on visual looks, the petal structure and the colours become far more important, and they become far more important than the pollinating and the nectar bearing elements to the plants, because pollen and nectar don't have any benefit to humans. So those are kind of being bred out. That's what I mean by putting originals in the garden, is that the better plants are the ones that can feed the natural world as well. And so to try and avoid those plants in the garden centres that look to have really loud, garish colour combinations or really complex petal structures, because these might not be any good for bees and butterflies and other insects and birds to feed from. And a good way, a good rule of thumb, is if you're walking around the garden centre and you see these plants all on display, have a look and see how many insects are buzzing around. Because if there is this huge, big, free larder of nectar all put together in the garden centre, these plants would be abuzz with butterflies and insects, wouldn't they? So if they're not, maybe they're no good. And that's one of the main criteria that I choose plants by now, is are they any good for insects? And if they're not, I'm sorry, but they do not actually qualify as any of the world's best plants, because they have only one purpose, which is to look pretty. And that's no good as far as I'm concerned. The plants that really, really work and constitute the world's best plants are those that are well-behaved, self-sufficient and adaptable plants. They're probably slower growing. They have the more natural looking petal shapes and colour combinations. You want them to be more than just a pretty face. So they need to smell nice. Maybe they're nice to touch. Maybe they have scented leaves, all of those sorts of things. Now, there's one class of plant that I always would advocate as being the world's best plants, because they tick all of those boxes 90% of the time. And that's to actually fill your garden as much as possible with bulbs, because bulbs, you can have them coming up all the way through the year from January to December, and the bulb will come up, it will do its thing, and it will disappear again. And you have to do very, very little to a bulb, apart from plant it in, pointy end up. That's about it. So in terms of the self-sufficiency, well-behaved and adaptable element, bulbs are fantastic. The only caveat to that is, if it says good for naturalising, don't put it in the garden. Bluebells really spread rapidly. Lily of the Valley can spread very, very rapidly. There are some alliums that do spread rather too rapidly and may just be a bit too much to have in the garden, so you need to check the label. So if I was going to be planting a garden and I had a few plants that I would kind of go, do you know, these for me are some of the world's best plants. These are the ones that I would always have. In terms of shrubs, I have my three favourites. The first one is Sarcococca. Now, this is known as Winterbox. It's a well-behaved green shrub with glossy green leaves, doesn't grow too quickly, is practically indestructible, but the best bit is in December and January is when it flowers, and the flowers have the most amazing smell. The second plant I would always have in the garden is a Skimmia japonica. Again, it's beloved by bees. It's well behaved. It just doesn't need really any attention at all. It has beautiful scented flowers. So again, it's a really, really good plant. And the other one I always really love is a plant called Fatsia japonica, which does get a bit big, but it's an evergreen plant. It has great big hand-shaped leaves. But actually, one of the nicest bits about Fatsia is just as the leaves are about to unfurl, they look like hands, a little uncurled hands, and you're waiting for those fingers to come up. It always looks nice. The bark is really interesting as well. It flowers in the winter time, and again, it provides really good pollen and nutrients for early foraging insects. And again, it's pretty indestructible. You can cut it back really hard and it just grows up again. In terms of three flowering plants, I would love to have, and some people don't like these, and I accept that, but these are my favourite. Anemone japonica, Japanese anemone, simply because it can grow in really tough spots, and you don't want to put it in the best spot in the garden list, by the way. Really tough, shady, dry spots, it will grow, and then it will produce these really beautiful, sort of simple daisy-like flowers that stand about 3 feet high, and it flowers for ages and ages and ages. And all I do is cut away the dead flowers once a year. It couldn't be simpler. Similarly, I love foxgloves because, again, once you've got them in the garden, they will just grow, do their thing, scatter their seeds, die down, and then the next lot come up. Bees love them. They look beautiful in the garden, whether they're the white variety or the purple variety or a mixture of both. The only thing I would say, obviously, with foxgloves is foxgloves are poisonous, but like anything, they're only poisonous if you ingest them. And actually, there is a special place in my heart for foxgloves because my youngest brother, when he was 6 weeks old, had a serious heart condition back in the 1980s. He was too young to have any of the heart medicine, so this poor little 6-week-old boy was having his head plunged into an ice bucket in order to shock his heart back into a sensible rhythm again. And we had to then give him digoxin for the next 18 months in a dropper form. And digoxin is the toxin that you get from digitalis, which is the foxglove. So it kept him alive. So I always have had foxgloves in my garden ever since. And the last plant I love, which some people think are terribly twee, but again, they never cause a problem, flower reliably, grow without misbehaving, and always look pretty even when they're not in flower, and those are geums. On top of that, there are some other plants that are always a must in my garden. Miscanthus morning light is a really beautiful grass. It's green and white and it's very well behaved and it doesn't make too much of a mess in terms of flopping over. Stipa tenuissima, which is the angel hair grass, you know, it's that really short one that you see, but it's great for just filling in gaps and just softening everything up. It does self-seed prolifically, so it's not the best thing to have upwind of your patio or gravel drive, for example, but it's very easy to get rid of. But it just always looks really pretty. And then in terms of bulbs, my favourite plants of all, I don't think I've ever had a garden without crocus, without tulips, and without alliums. So there you go. That's my guide giving you the world's best plants for your garden. Now, I accept I haven't told you exactly which ones they are, but each garden has a different environment, and so some plants would be more suitable than others. But the ones that I've just given you there are pretty good and will survive most gardens, especially in the United Kingdom. So I hope you go out and enjoy being in your garden when the rain stops raining and spring finally springs upon us. It will be lovely. I will look forward to speaking to you next week. In the meantime, please send me your questions. Please send me your pictures. You can email them to me, rachel@plantplots.com. I'd love to see your gardens. You can find loads of information on the website at plantplots.com about all aspects of gardening and garden design. We've got border planting designs you can download for the garden. Please go and take a look. You can subscribe, it would be very much appreciated. You can do that via Ko-fi/plantplots. And I look forward to speaking to you next week. Have a lovely day, guys.